Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James is in Japan, living there for the past 10 years or more, and very intelligent man. We have James on the program almost weekly, not quite. He has other things to do once in a while. But always a pleasure talking to him. Always look forward to it. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I am flattered and honored to once again be your guest, and I'm looking forward to another exciting conversation.
Yeah, let's hope it works out that way. You know, one of the things that I like about live radio interviews and any of the live activity, it's always like a boxing match from my perspective. You step into the ring and see if you can go for the full hour or 40 minutes or whatever it is. And sometimes you get out, and sometimes, you know, you get out and you kind of win the match. And sometimes, you know, it doesn't work out that way, but it's live.
Yep.
And that adds something to it for me.
There's no redos, that means no edits.
Yep. Just run and gun and hope for the best. I've got an article here from the New York Times, and it says, Japan's economy expands, but less than expected. Japan emerged from a recession in the final quarter of 2014, but wages adjusted for inflation are still falling. Government data showed the economic growth, the country's first since early last year, was weaker than experts had forecast. In a preliminary report, the Cabinet Office said gross product had expanded at an annual rate of 2.2%. In the quarter through December, the economy had contracted in each of the two previous quarters, and they go on. And so, according to this article, Japan hasn't done as well in the last quarter as they had hoped, but they did better than they did in the previous two quarters. Here in the United States, we have a problem trusting that the numbers we get from our government are reliable. Do you have that same kind of problem with the government of Japan? Are they likely to be deceiving the people and telling them things are better than they really are? Or can we count on their information and say, no, this is probably honest?
Oh, I think we can count on the fact that every government manipulates statistics to make them seem as good as they possibly can, and they do that in different ways. I'm not necessarily going to even get into the GDP argument itself, although I think there is obviously a very good question about the methods by which we can actually calculate the sum total of the gross domestic product of a country and how accurate those numbers are in the general. But even beyond that, I think that the important point is the point that the New York Times tries to sideline in that sentence, talking about the fact that, well, when adjusted for inflation, actually wages continue to fall. That is the real story of the Japanese economy, and that isn't a minor footnote here. That's really the I think the crux of the issue, because one thing that the Bank of Japan and Abenomics has been genuinely good at, I suppose, from a certain perspective, is to simply inflate the stock market by devaluing the currency. They've been very good at that, and the yen is continuing to go down against the dollar, and as a result, the Nikkei index continues to go up, and that looks like a good thing when you calculate statistics in a certain way. But the underlying point of this, as even Abe and others have talked about all along, is it's not just they're trying to inflate the stock market. What they're supposedly really trying to do is to get corporate wealth generated again, so that will trickle down and they'll start giving that some of those benefits down to the workers, so that money can start traveling through the economy and actually make a genuine difference in the economy here. That has not happened under this Abenomics. Real wages continue to decline, and I forget how many months in a row it is now, but it's we're going into years of straight real wage decline in Japan, and the standard of living of the Japanese workers continues to deteriorate, and that is a crisis for a number of reasons. But when you add on the demographic crisis that underlies what's going on here in Japan, and the fact that this is a dying country, literally more deaths than births last year, and a decreasing population, and an aging population, I think the oldest population on the planet in terms of average age, but certainly the largest percentage of 100-plus-year-olds, and that's not going to change. That's not going to get better. That's going to get even worse from the perspective of even fewer workers supporting even more retirees, and that ratio is only increasing. So it is it's a lot of crises stacked on top of each other. So even if there is some sort of GDP growth because of some sort of ways in which equity inflation has caused some better, you know, bottom line for a few big corporations, that is not having an effect on the average Japanese citizen here. And I can personally attest to that from my experience here on the ground.
I saw a report back a month ago, perhaps, and they said Japan last year sold more adult diapers than children's diapers.
It's true. Yeah. It's crazy.
That's astonishing. Yeah.
That's a good sign of something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a danger sign, and you're making the comment that the nation is dying. What do the people of Japan think about this? Do they think they will muddle through and things will work out? Are they in a state of anxiety or depression or just keeping their mouths shut and keep their nose to the grindstone? What are they doing to deal with the idea that their nation may be dying?
I think there's a combination of those reactions that you talked about there, and sort of the Japanese way. I think there is anxiety over this phenomenon, but it's, you know, don't rock the boat and don't try to disturb the system too much, because the system has more or less reliably taken care of a couple of generations of Japanese since the end of the war. The system that was put in place worked out fairly well for a large degree of the population in terms of just improving standard of living, and obviously Japan being a sort of behemoth lion of the economy, of the world economy for the past, for a couple of decades there. Obviously, yeah, that's cooled down in recent years, and now we're seeing this general and gradual deterioration in people's conditions. But still, there's something of the sense that people have had here for generations now that as long as you just go into a job and stay with that career in that corporation, as long as you can land that, then you're going to be okay. And there's still something, I think some people are still taking that mentality. But yeah, there's definitely a dawning realization that things are changing here fundamentally. And you just can't ignore the fact that this is an aging population. And another statistic that I've pointed to before, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but the average age of the average farmer here in Japan is something around 72 years old. It's that's a very worrying sign because, again, so much of Japanese society and culture and history has grown up around the idea that every family has their own little rice paddy where they all go to harvest the rice, you know, in the fall, and they all share in that. And that's a great part of the culture, I think, and something that perhaps other cultures around the world could learn from. But unfortunately, it's going the other way. Japanese society is becoming more sort of generally westernized, I guess. And there's the urbanization that has taken place here in the past couple of decades, especially, that has basically depleted the countryside of people. And now, so it's just the sort of grandparents of these families are the ones that are maintaining these little rice paddies. And that's going to go by the wayside in the next generation if this demographic trend continues. So again, there's a lot of different crises that are piling up, and I don't know, it's pretty hard to have an optimistic outlook for the Japanese economy or the condition of the average Japanese worker at this point. And I don't think any but the most deluded really believe that, which is why there's so much anger here at the political class in general, and sort of a throw your hands up, well, what are you going to do kind of attitude that towards this current government, which is still in power and recently won an election again, but it wasn't an election of popular support or enthusiasm. It was kind of a, well, it's what else are we going to do kind of election win. So it's a pretty bad situation all around.
You talked about the trickle-down theory, the idea that they would inflate the currency, it would be good for the stock market, and it would trickle down to ordinary people. We've seen the same idea here in this country with the idea we'll give the money to the banks that are too big to fail, and it will trickle down to the ordinary people. Do you believe the trickle-down theory is valid, and do you know of instances when it has actually worked as advertised?
It's difficult to think of one, isn't it? Certainly, the theory does make a certain sense, you would think, if there's a...
Yeah, logically.
Exactly.
It makes sense, and then you get the real world, and...
Exactly right. It always tends to work out somewhat differently, and I would say that that's because the emphasis in such a system is the exact wrong way around, which is that all of this mana starts at the top of the apex of this financial pyramid, the monetary pyramid, the central bank, which is doing its monetary easing and fiscal stimulus. And then it goes into that layer below, which is the sort of corporatocracy of this, you know, the standard centralized industrial corporations, which control so much of the economy here and in many, many nations around the world. And then it goes down to the level below it of the workers. And I think, again, when you have a centralized system like that that's being dictated from the top, obviously at every single level, there's going to, at the very least, be a lot of sticky fingers getting in between that trickle to prevent it getting further down the ladder. And that's even if everyone here has the genuine good intention of actually seeing the sort of lower levels of that pyramid of power actually receive any of the benefits of this. And I think there are people with a quite obvious interest in keeping the people at the bottom at the bottom. So again, it makes sense from some sort of logical systemic viewpoint, but in the real world, it doesn't seem to work that way, which is why I think the real revolution that has to happen is, I guess, the inversion of that pyramid, or just the destruction of that pyramid system, where rather than having a centralized economy dictated by a central bank and these large industrial centralized corporations, we have to look at the ways to basically explode that notion that we've had now since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, really, that all of the manufacturing and productivity has to take place in these centralized locations by these coordinated corporations and groups of people, rather than the sort of feudal idea, which went by the wayside, of artisans and craftsmen and tradesmen and guilds and that sort of thing working at a more local level. We have now reached the technological point that can bring us back to that level of production, which actually works a lot more logically and with a lot less waste and a lot more harmonious, I guess, if we use a inexact term, that wasn't really possible in the mass production factory system era, but is becoming possible again. I really believe it's becoming possible again because of the further advancements of technology to present these types of decentralized systems that are now possible, with decentralized production possible through open source and 3D printing and all of these revolutions that are taking place right now. So in the old paradigm, the old model, everything comes from a central bank and centralized corporations, and everything is centralized. I think the decentralized model is the real solution to this, not looking for more mana from heaven from the central bank, but getting rid of the central banking system altogether.
Well, from my perspective, that trickle-down theory, the flaw in it is that one of the key attitudes for anyone I've ever seen who got to be rich is that they are generally so tight they won't spend a nickel if they don't have to. And therefore, if you give them billions of dollars, they're going to say thank you very much, but it is not going to trickle down to the great unwashed. If you wanted to do this economy some good, you should take all of the money and give it to the poorest people in the country. Because generally speaking, they will not save anything no matter what. You give them $1 billion and it'll be gone by the end of the year. They'll figure a way to spend it and it will trickle up. And then the wealthy people have an opportunity to get their hands on it. So in any case, that's my the trickle-down theory.
I agree with you that
super rich, I think you're right.
Well, I agree that the trickle up would be theoretically better than the trickle down. At any rate, it would work better, and I agree with that. But I still think that's caught in the wrong paradigm, where it still has to come from this centralized system of control, the central bank dictating where it'll go. And we'll see if Syriza, for example, manages to pull off something like that in Greece, and whether it transforms the Greek economy, and if just socialism for the masses will really, you know, be the answer that we're looking for. I really don't believe it is, but I understand why it appeals to people. And as I say, it would be better than the system we have now, at any rate.
I've got an article from Yahoo Finance, and the headline is Peter Schiff: QE4 will send gold towards new high. He's predicting we're going into quantitative easing 4, And then, of course, if we do, that will be the government trying to inflate the currency, pump more currency, inflate the dollar, pump more currency into the economy. Do you agree that we're going into QE4? Do you think we're headed in that direction? And if so, do you think it's going, they will succeed in restoring inflation?
I don't see how they can avoid another type of easing program or stimulus program at this point. Yep. And just because I can't see it doesn't mean that it can't work out that way. I'm not trying to make a logically fallacious argument here, but it truly just boggles the imagination that they could proceed forward without further stimulus, because as QE3 and the end of QE3 has shown us quite drastically, I think, all of this inflation of the stock market over the past several years has been due to these easing programs and the monetary stimulus. Take that away, and underlying the economy is really, I mean, nothing in terms of productive, actual market growth. So I agree. I think there will have to be a QE4, but we are going in the opposite direction, the insanity that apparently the Fed is still committed to cutting rates this year. Raising rates this year. And I just,
They talk about it, but I'll wait. I'm waiting.
Exactly. I'll believe it when I see it. And then when I see it, I'd like to see what the results of that would be, because it truly does completely go against the reality on the ground in every way, except for the fact that the U.S. dollar really is on a bull tear right now. And really has been,
but in the last week or so, it's shown a little bit of a decline, and it's not long enough to... You know, we don't have a trend here we can count on, but it's not rocketing toward 100. Let's take a break for some commercial announcements, and I'll be back with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com, in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett from Corbett Report, thecorbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And James has a lot of intelligent information, opinion, commentary. Visit his website, and you should be interested and hopefully pleased. We've got an article from Fox News. Egyptian beheadings show ISIS taking global jihad to the rest of Arab world. They're not just content to go after the Christians and the Jews. They apparently intend to go after other Arab governments as well. The article says, in part, says the Islamic State's mass execution of Egyptian Christians is the latest sign that ISIS is pointing its sword against not just the West, but also the rest of the Arab world, drawing the region into a spreading war that leaves the United States in a difficult spot as it tries to marshal a cohesive coalition. That coalition started last fall, U.S.-led airstrike campaign involving several states, but several other countries in the Middle East and North Africa are now launching their own military campaigns against ISIS. Is ISIS simply so fanatical that they're going to fight for their faith no matter what? They don't care if there's 1,000 men, one Muslim, he's going to go after them. It doesn't matter. Are they fanatical, or have they lost their minds, or what is motivating these people?
Well, first of all, let's not conflate Arab with Muslim. There are Egyptian Christians, for example, others. So that is, to a certain extent, I think, what is implied by the Fox News headline there about taking the jihad to the rest of the Arab world. But I think, yes, I mean, let's examine this in a couple of ways. First of all, the actual real Islamic State militants who really are on the ground and really are doing these things and beheading people and what have you. Yes, I think they are motivated by Islamic extremism and fanaticism, and truly they absolutely do see themselves in a certain tradition and a certain branch of Islam, and those who are not in that branch are, I'm sure, fair game to these terrorists, which is why we've seen the things that they've done in Iraq, for example, and in Syria, to people that you would expect, well, they're all Muslim, they're all the same. Well, evidently not. And that's, of course, playing on the old deep-seated divisions and sectarian within Islam itself. as well as the other aspects to this. I mean, the Islamic State, according to Telegraph, planning to use Libya as gateway to Europe. Well, I guess in a way, it's kind of all coming full circle, because as we know, the U.S. and NATO generally have been sponsoring various extremists in Libya for years now, as originally as part of their plan to topple Gaddafi. But of course, once that happened, well, then the guns and other things had to be start running into Syria, where they get picked up by the Islamic State, who is now planning to use Libya as a gateway to Europe. So all of this comes full circle, and it's all, I think, has to be seen in that greater geopolitical machinations that have been going on for years now to fund and supply and arm and train and otherwise foster the very groups that end up, oh my God, wouldn't you believe it? Who would have guessed it? Turning against the Europeans and against America, and providing the big, very excuse that they've been looking for to get re-involved in Iraq and more specifically in Syria. So again, I think I look at this sort of with a very jaundiced eye. And although, of course, there really are Islamic State fighters who really are radicals and extremists and fundamentalists who believe in what they're doing, I think that the larger geopolitical reality is that this couldn't take place without complicity, really, when you think about it, in a lot of different ways, from the intelligence agencies and the various aid and military and financial support that have found their way somehow to this nebulous group in the last few years.
It's a pretty extraordinary, and they seem to be attacking anything that they can see that moves. Now, I know that's an exaggeration, but you know, they're not going to focus in one place. I've seen reports that suggest that these people are following their faith and they have their own end times theology. And in end times, they are anticipating that Muslim armies will sweep over the world under the Quran. And in our end times, we're anticipating that some sort of agents of Satan and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. It's strange. I don't know that you're a spiritual person. That's, you know, your business one way or the other. But do you think the end times philosophy, theology, do you think that's catching on in the world to a point where it's not just something people are talking about? Is it beginning to happen, right or wrong? Are we beginning to, you know, adopt those values, those objectives?
I think the apocalyptic mindset has absolutely entered into the popular consciousness in the past decade or two in a way that it hasn't, I think, occupied people's attention in a long time. And I would say that because we see a lot more of the framing of either this religious battle that the as it's framed, Islam versus Christianity or whatever, or the sort of civilization battle. It's the Western civilization versus the Islamic civilization, broadly defined, or what have you. And in whatever way you figure that, it does seem to be coming to some sort of great battle, some kind of great head. And I think that's the general narrative that's been presented to us academically by Francis Fukuyama and others who have been arguing about this civilization crisis, and as well, of course, culturally and through the types of Hollywood predictive programming that people watch and things of that nature. So I think there's been a lot of play on this idea of apocalypse and end times and things of that nature, which, again, I think can be convenient for spearheading certain political agendas. I mean, if you're aim is to say, if you do want to militarily and politically or otherwise conquer a certain region of the globe, then it's great to be able to motivate the people in your polity against that region of the globe on whatever narrative you can, whether that is religious or civilizational or ethnic or cultural or racial or whatever it is, as long as you can play on some sort of dividing line and play that up. So again, this should not come as a surprise to students of history who know how populations can be whipped into war hysteria generally, but the idea that is playing on this end times philosophy, I think, is particularly disturbing, because of course that brings to mind mushroom clouds or whatever it is. I mean, you know, epical kind of, you know, world changing events that, unfortunately, I mean, if the it, not only if the wrong people get into power or use that power in the wrong way on the wrong day, but even if just someone makes a mistake and something goes wrong. I mean, we know that the world can be destroyed many times over with the technology we already have at our disposal, let alone what's being developed in the bowels of the Pentagon. So it's not a fun concept to be playing with right now. And I'm aware of this phenomenon, and I to a certain extent, am very wary of it and the way it can be played upon, and as a powerful part of people's psyche and a powerful motivator for people who are religiously inclined, for example.
Well, what disturbs me about this is the idea, you know, I understand that Christians are, many believe we are in or approaching end times. I get that. I'm not necessarily all that far from that position myself. But if they're the only ones that are talking about it, well, it's not that big a deal. But if you have Muslims coming up at the same time and saying, yeah, you're right, buddy, they also believe we are in or close to end times. Now we've got two conflicting religions who both agree that end times are close at hand, and that will begin to explain what's happening for a lot of people. And the problem is, it's certainly conducive to holy war, the worst kind of war you can ever get into, because in holy war, there is no compromise. If you're fighting for God, there's no, well, let's make a deal. There are no deals. There's just absolute annihilation. Secular warfare, which is what our government fights, they'll cut a deal. They'll go kick somebody around for a while, and then they say, listen, we're going to make you a deal you can't refuse. And you give us 10, 15% of your crude oil, and we'll leave you alone. That's secular warfare. Holy warfare, we're going to kill you all if you don't agree with our ideas. And when we see two sides getting into that same mentality at the same time, that I look at it and say, oh, I'm not taking any trips to the Middle East. Have you ever visited the Middle East?
I have not, no. And I mean, that's, I would love the opportunity, but like you, I mean, obviously there's so much to consider with regards to that situation, but it's, I think even more than just external, just talking about different places of the globe or different cultures entirely, I think it's internal and has been fostered for decades as well. I mean, we're looking at Europe right now specifically, and this sort of racial, ethnic, cultural tension that's now boiling to the surface, that's been there for quite a while now and has been simmering, but now there seems to be coming to a head, at least in the narrative that's being painted in the media. And again, I think these are powerful forces of division that can be played on by political and financial and other forces to really keep the population, again, divided amongst each other, which is always, I mean, throughout history, for thousands of years, this has been the way to control populations, is to keep them divided against each other so that they are dependent on the supreme authority at the top. And it's extremely effective. It pushes the exact right buttons in the human psyche to get people, even people who know better and who understand how these manipulations take place, to, well, you got to pick a side, and you know, you got to protect your family and your civilization and your culture and your race, so you better be against those people. And it's very effective, and it creates divisions, and those divisions manifest in reality because people believe in them, and then that further inculcates it. It's a feedback loop. So I mean, we're really going to have to answer, as a species on this planet, we're going to have to answer the question of how to come out of that, how to outgrow that feedback loop, how to get around this problem, or we will be facing it head on in the coming years. And it's not going to be pretty. I mean, I think we're just seeing the very leading edge of this. And in places like in Europe, what we've seen in Paris and in Copenhagen and other places recently, I think this is just the taste of what we're going to be looking at more and more.
Do you think we'll see rising nationalism in these countries where they're, from the perspective of the people within the countries that are born there, they're going to look at the foreign immigrants as something like invaders? And the immigrants frequently don't care to be assimilated. They want to just come there and set up their own country, essentially, their own system of values, their own culture. They're not coming to be French, right? They're coming. Is this conducive to rising nationalism? And if so, you know, is this headed for ethnic cleansing, genocide, that sort of thing? Or can we expect more of that?
Actually, interestingly, I think it's not going to be rising nationalism, but actually the kind of disintegration of nationalism. It's no longer about the nation. It's no longer about I am French or I am Canadian or whatever. It's now about I'm this ethnic group, or I am this cultural group, or I am this race, and that is my identity. And these other people, they may live in my nation, but they're not part of us. And I think that's the boundaries that are going to be played on, which the ultimate end logic of that could play very well into a global governmental system. Well, no, it's not about nation. It's about who you are. And if you want to live in sort of your own civilization or your own culture or your own race or your own religion, okay, but it's got to be organized in some way. Let's organize it at the global level. I think it could play into that type of narrative, which is what I would be very wary of. And from that perspective, we have to look at the economic infrastructure and the political infrastructure that has enabled this to take place, where we now have these sort of economic migrants, as you say, who move maybe halfway around the world for economic reasons, but not to culturally integrate, not to learn the language, not to be mm-hmm. a part of that culture. And that has been enabled at the political level by decisions that have been made over decades. And one can only imagine, I mean, this is the inevitable result of that. So I'm sure that the people who put this system into place, at least some of them, had an awareness that this is where this was leading.
I think it's dangerous. Yeah, I understand that you can introduce foreign elements into a particular nation, and people wind up being so busy fighting with the guy across the street that they don't have time to realize that the real adversary may be at their state or national capital. All right, I'm going to fight with a Muslim across the street rather than fight with a congressman or the president in Washington, D.C. Do you think this loss of nationalism, do you think that's good or bad?
Well, ultimately, I'm not a big fan of nation-state idea generally, but having said that, I'm an even bigger opponent of the global system. So if it's in that dichotomy, then yes, I think nation-state sort of identity is more important than being subsumed into some sort of global government-type collective. Mm-hmm. But then again, I'd like to see the debate completely framed in a different way, so that it's about human beings living on this planet without the need for permission from a government, for example, to cross an imaginary line on a map or things of that nature, not in a global governmental system where we're all just beholden to some global government, but as free individual human beings able to interact with each other. And I know that's a long way off from where we are now, but that's the way I'd like to frame it to sort of understand it, rather than pitting nation state versus global government and you have to choose. I think that's a false choice, and we've been railroaded into it quite effectively over the past several decades.
Well, I'm going to have to let it go at that, James. I always appreciate talking to you. It's always interesting. I enjoy it. This is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And we will be back. James will be gone next week, but the following week, he'll be back in 2 weeks. I believe that's true, right?
Yes.
Okay. James, thank you very much. I'm Alfred Addis, folks. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.